Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And tonight we are going to discuss our... Tonight we have a one-hour interview, actually. It's pre-recorded from last night's show. However, it is about... Andrew Craig, with Andrew Craig, who's a reporter and former reporter and attorney.
He's executive director of the Justice Project.
The founder of the Justice and Integrity Project.
Mm-hmm.
Investigating, which is a nonprofit, investigating the political prosecutions by the George W. Bush administration, right? And over 600 people over the Bush period, eight years, were
targeted in various states.
But for, you know, politically prosecuted, mm-hmm, for bogus crimes and bogus bull, and just to get them out of office and to,
pave the way for Republican.
Republican majorities in the House and Senate. And also on the judiciary, judges and prosecutors and so on were all fired and prosecuted.
And governors.
Yeah, and governors.
Yeah.
And so we...
They were targeting also fundraisers for the Democratic Party.
Democratic Party fundraisers. It's really quite,
extensive. And shocking.
And what I think what's worse is that the Obama administration, which you'll find, has done nothing and refuses to do anything about these horrible... miscarriages of justice.
It's really an abuse of
terrible
power.
Terrible abuse of power. So we're going to play that now, starting now, and and I hope you enjoy it.
I don't know whether you'll enjoy it, but you'll become more informed.
Better
informed. At least I did by talking to him.
Oh, yeah, extremely informed. Plus, we talk about the Kagan nomination as well. And which is even more astounding, how she was able to...
No one really
was
talking much about it.
Yeah, and he actually wrote an article, and as a progressive Democrat, or a progressive populist, which says he is, he actually came out against Kagan, and we will talk in a great deal about the Kagan appointment. So here's the interview now, and I hope you enjoy it, and we'll be back right after. This is about an hour long. And if you don't catch it, it'll be in the archives as well, right after the program. So here we go.
All right, Andrew Craig. He is an executive director of the Justice Integrity Project. He spent two decades as an attorney. He's actually an author, too. He's an author of a book called Spiked, and it's about economics and politics and how economics and politics has shaped the newspaper industry. He actually was a reporter for the Hartford Courant, our own Hartford Courant here in Hartford. He was an investigative reporter, and he has law degrees from the University of Chicago and from Yale University, and I believe his undergraduate degree is from Cornell, not too far from here.
Hello, Andrew. How are you?
Very good. Great to be on the show.
Glad to have you on, Andrew. My name is Lila.
Hi, Lila.
You know, you're a blessing in disguise in more ways than one here for this show. But we thank you for being on. But I have been doing some research on Kagan's nomination, and I tell you, I've been coming up rather slim, for the last few months. But
now,
I'm so glad that you did you're up on that, and you're willing to talk to our audience about it.
Now, it's my understanding that the Justice Integrity Project opposed her. Is that true?
That's correct.
And can you tell our audience why?
Well, we looked into her quite extensively beginning last November.
Hmm.
Of course, we followed her career even before that as Solicitor General and Dean of Harvard Law School, and she was prominent in the Clinton administration.
Hmm.
But once you find... find out some things about some of these people, it starts to make you look even at their accomplishments with a skeptical eye. And the bottom line is that we opposed her on civil rights and constitutional grounds, and in doing so, it was a very unusual position. I doubt if even a single U.S. senator would have put it that way. But that's why they have radio shows, and I'm delighted to amplify, and particularly any questions you or your listeners might have.
Well, it seems to me that she got pushed through rather quickly, and to have it happen in August I thought was kind of unusual.
Well, I think, as well as others I've been working with, that this had been set up a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I recently wrote an article about this. Actually, it was published this week. And I used the old memoir of the boxer, Rocky Graziano, who wrote his memoirs, and he entitled it, "Somebody Up There Likes Me."
I remember that.
And I think in her case, somebody up there liked her. I mean, she's very close friends with Barack Obama, which is a good place to be. But if you look back also over her career, there are many of these kinds of relationships that are quite impressive unless you start wondering, well, what's in it for the common person here?
Mm-hmm.
And... Please interrupt at any time. But
no, keep going.
My group looks into cases of prosecution misconduct where authorities, for whatever reason, seem like they're really out to get somebody, often somebody big. And maybe later in the show we'll talk about some of those people, like Bernard Carrick from New York and Don Siegelman, the former governor of Alabama. Well, Elena Kagan last November, as Solicitor General, argued to the U.S. Supreme Court that Don Siegelman, the Alabama governor, should not be reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court. And for those of us who have looked deeply into that case, and conclude, as I do, that he was framed and put away, you have to wonder, why is she doing this? And if she's a Democrat and she's supposed to be some big liberal, why does she want the number one victim of Karl Rove's political prosecutions to go to prison for 20 years when he didn't do anything? And... So I won't talk forever without question me on this.
Well, I'm sorry. I have somehow I lost you a little bit on that.
She's Solicitor General of the Justice Department.
That I knew, right.
Last November, she writes a brief to the U.S. Supreme Court which she wants to join.
Mm-hmm.
Don't hear the case of this Alabama governor who's convicted on corruption charges.
Mm-hmm.
And while that might be a very standard thing for somebody working at the Justice Department to do, for those of us who have researched that Alabama case and believe that Siegelman, the governor, was framed, you then start looking at the rest of Kagan's record, and you start finding other things that are disturbing.
Well, I think the one that disturbed me most was when she was defending the right for censorship, all right, in the Supreme Court.
Yes.
That really bothered me, that she would be a liberal, you know, minded person and be advocating, censorship. And, news speak and government speak, you know?
Well, that's exactly what I mean, that once you start looking beyond her well-known advocacy for gay rights at Harvard, and maybe she's not so liberal at all on some of these other issues. And the larger pattern, to go back to the question of why in June we opposed her, when it certainly looked like she was going to be confirmed,
mm-hmm.
is we thought it was important to take a stand here whether or not she's going to be confirmed. And the stand is this deference to executive power for her friend Barack Obama. It's a little bit like when Bush wanted Harriet Myers, his friend, to be
right.
in the Supreme Court.
Right. It's no different, really.
And she was shot down.
But Harriet was a little less, had a little less clout, even though she was best friends with Bush. She didn't. She hadn't made the grade with everybody else, I guess.
Well,
Elena Kagan, to give her credit, and in my office I've got all kinds of incredibly impressive testimonials, including from 80 law school deans. That's the deans, not just professors.
Yeah, but they're
she really reached out and made quite a impressive career for herself. However, again, once you have this skepticism, you say, well, she's never been a judge.
Mm-hmm.
All of it's been kind of this wheeler-dealering. And is that really what we need?
Yeah, and not only that, I mean, can't Obama and all of his buddies just call up these deans of different law schools and say, hey, you know, just sign off on this little letter we wrote.
There's a lot of that, although having gone to, as you mentioned in the bio, two of the best of law schools, and I know both deans who signed the letters on behalf of Chicago and Yale. I don't quite think that's how it works. I think it's a little more subtle, and I think they genuinely know her because she was dean of Harvard Law School. But it's still a good old boy kind of network.
Well, is the dean of Yale? Yale Law School gave her a recommendation, you said?
Well, there were 80.
80,
yeah, there are 80 of them.
Virtually every law school who signed the letter.
Every law school.
That was incredibly impressive on her behalf.
Does that happen to anybody else? Does anybody else get 80 letters of recommendation from...
It's very hard. So this is impressive, but here's one other thing, as long as we're talking about 80 and counting the numbers.
The right buttons,
91 former state attorney generals wrote the Supreme Court on behalf of this Governor Siegelman and said, you should hear his corruption case. And that has never before happened in American history. So to make a little bit of a joke out of it, yes, she got 80 to say she should be on the Supreme Court. But Siegelman got 91
didn't help him.
To say he didn't commit a crime, so why should he be sentenced to 20 years in prison?
Right.
Well, they didn't seem to have as much clout, did they?
Well, ultimately, no. On June 29th of this year, the Supreme Court vacated most of the charges against Siegelman.
Interesting.
And he's still not off the hook because he has to go back to a Republican majority appeals court that helped railroad him to prison. He's a Democrat down there in Alabama.
When you say vacated the charges, what exactly does that mean?
Vacated means they threw out the charges.
They threw out the charges.
So in effect, the great legal scholar Kagan not only argued that somebody who was framed should go back to prison, but she lost the legal argument.
Right, and now she's on the Supreme Court.
Now she's on the Supreme Court. And again, I've talked to a number of people who are big advocates of her on various grounds. She's apparently a very nice person. In fact, she lives just about 200 feet from where I live, and I think I ran into her at a drugstore about 2 weeks ago. I almost said hello. But she's apparently a very nice person. But and she's got all these recommendations.
But I'm a nice person, and nobody's nominating me to the Supreme Court.
And you know what? We just had a guy. There was just a guy in Manchester, Connecticut, who killed 8 of his coworkers, who they all said was a great guy.
Right.
What a nice guy this guy was.
Right.
A sweetheart. You know,
let me ask you this. My question about her is, well, who does she know? Who is her mentor? Who really advocated for her?
Okay, number one is Barack Obama, who's one of her best friends.
Okay.
So you start with that. They taught at the University of Chicago Law School in the early 90s together, and they're just big buds. She is a former Rhodes Scholar, Harvard Law graduate. She worked at a very brief legal experience at Williams & Connolly, whose clients include the Washington Post, which absolutely loves Elena Kagan, the Washington Post. Williams & Connolly is this great, stellar law firm that represents, it's kind of a walking conflict of interest, they represent Obama, Clinton, Bush, Cheney, Rove, the whole works, including they represented Richard Helms of the CIA in his big case. And so to answer your question, her whole career is like that, where there's all kinds of people behind her. I mean, here's two other names. One is she was on the board of advisors for Goldman Sachs.
Oh, my God.
And also she served in the Clinton administration. So her concept, yes, she clerked on the Supreme Court for Thurgood Marshall, and that's often brought up. But we've got 1.5 million lawyers in this country. My view is, why don't we try to find the next Thurgood Marshall?
instead of his law clerk, you know?
Instead of a clerk.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's frightening. It's frightening. But what I don't understand, and I fail to understand this, is how these, I don't know, the Senate Judiciary Committee that nominated her, that allowed her to go through, I recall, and I could not get a copy of that to play it, but her first day, okay, I believe that Senator Sessions, I think, was ranted and raved, not raved over, but called her down, I guess, for quite some time. I guess he had nothing good to say about her. Was that true or not?
Yes, it is. But it's theater.
It's theater, yeah.
I compare it to like a movie, a Western movie, where they're pulling their punches and they're making a big, professional wrestling is better.
Professional wrestling.
Sessions and these Republicans are trying to create a big dust up and appeal to their base, but they really don't want to get into it because on some of these most sensitive issues, they're on the same side. You've identified some of your concerns, and they really point to executive power, that what the president says, the Justice Department, say the Supreme Court's going to ratify on some of these civil rights and corporation issues.
Very scary.
Well, the Republicans are gung-ho for that.
I have a question for you. What's your opinion of today's announcement by, or statement by Gibbs, the press secretary, that he was out against the progressives, and said that especially those who called, which we have done here many times on the show, called him
Obama,
another Bush, okay, or
right,
as bad or worse than Bush, all right. And Gibbs said that we were all smoking, we were all on heavy drugs.
Well, he's going to, I saw that Congressman Ellison from Minnesota said that should be grounds to fire Gibbs the guy is supposed to be a press secretary. He's supposed to have some control over
what he says. Yeah.
And a lot of these people seem to find it very easy to insult part of their base.
Yeah.
And it's his base.
That's the only thing holding this jerk up, you know, right now.
Oh, exactly.
I mean, without him, without his base, he's
without his progressives, he's done.
He's impeached. I mean, he might as well be impeached. There's already stuff out there. The Tea Party wants him impeached, so why not?
Well, here's two questions that I might ask. You know, we all expect that they really care about all of this stuff, just like everybody was supposed to feel sorry for Senator Lieberman and Dodd across the border if they left office. Well, they're going to make a fortune if they leave office as lobbyists.
Yeah, sure.
And here's a little fact that one of my friends is an investigative reporter here in Washington, just put together a birthday bio of Obama, This Is Your Life, things that most people don't know about him and should. And let me just run this by you, and I'll confess,
sure,
I didn't know it. But do you know who Tim Geithner's father was, the Treasury Secretary? And I won't put you on the spot by asking.
Do I know who his father was? No.
Well, his father, Peter Geithner, was Obama's, the boss for Obama's mother at the Ford Foundation. And so here's this guy, Tim Geithner, who comes in. He's basically running the economy almost as Treasury Secretary. And he didn't pay some taxes, even though the Treasury collects taxes.
That's right.
He didn't know what the law is.
Yeah, the Treasury Secretary.
And he comes from, you know, the same financial industry that had the meltdown, and he's the big regulator. And why do we not all know, and I didn't, that his father and Obama's mother were tight.
Yeah.
That's interesting, isn't it? Hmm.
And that's, you know, to me as an investigative reporter.
So you think Obama and Geithner were playmates in the sandbox there?
No, they weren't playmates in the sandbox, but
no,
just to stretch it out or illustrate it.
Might have been.
Obama's mother was based in Indonesia, part of her career,
right,
as a grantee from the Ford Foundation.
Mm.
And the person who approved the grant was Geithner's father, based in New York.
Mm.
And you start looking at these relationships, and maybe it's no big deal, but it's the type of thing that those of us who are investigative reporters and then wonder why are things the way they are, we at least think about.
As they say, there are no coincidences.
No, not in politics.
Not in politics.
Well, here's another one.
No,
go ahead.
That I'll just touch on, but there may be a very heavy undercurrent in the Obama White House and presidency and in his background that people aren't really thinking about, of you know, his mother is involved with Kenya and Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what was going on in the early 60s with those countries? Well, they were major outposts of the battle of the U.S. versus communism for Africa
But the Ford Foundation, as well as the Carnegie Foundation, and the Ford and Carnegie, both foundations were actually subversive foundations. They still are to this day. Evidence that points that these foundations have actually been working toward destruction of this country in many, many, many ways. That was proven back in the 50s, all right, by a number of people.
Yeah, I mean, it's really an incredibly heartwarming story, and I know I was touched during the campaign, and I was, I'll share with you, an early and strong contributor, and I rang doorbells and did everything like that for Obama.
Oh,
but these are not connections that we knew about during a campaign, at least I didn't. Mm-hmm. And now that we see this kind of retraction on a whole host of issues and how the inner circle just sneers at the base, like Gibbs, he knows.
Well, you know, it's no different than what George Bush did to the Christian right, okay? When he came in, everything was, oh, Christian this and Christ this,
right,
and born again this and born again that. And everybody, and then he started the, you know.
He made promises to them that he never fulfilled.
Yeah, and he laughed at Karl Rove, and he laughed at these guys, okay, even though they were supposedly his base. They got them all worked up on gay marriage and,
abortion
and every other thing that would make them run to the polls. And then they just told them to screw off, and they invaded Afghanistan, they invaded Iraq, you know, they gave one of the biggest tax cuts in history to the top 1%, all right, and they just screwed over everybody, okay, and laughed about it. And this is the same way I feel about Obama. You know, we put him in there. You know, people that felt there was some legitimacy to what he was about, and he turns out he did nothing but sneer at us, and like that statement he made in Canada. Or one of his managers in Canada that, don't believe anything that he says. He's just saying to get elected. All right?
Now, that was University of Chicago economist Austin Goolsbee.
Right, which is one of his buddies, isn't it?
Right. Well, he's in the administration.
Yeah.
I should probably be more scared to say all stuff on radio, but, one of the very bone-chilling concepts that also comes out of the University of Chicago. In fact, one of my own professors, who's now in the administration, wrote a law review essay 2 years ago that said, in effect, well, there are bad ideas out there, and we can either forbid bad ideas, or we can tax the bad ideas, or we can hire government agents to pretend to be journalists and academics and disrupt those areas where bad ideas flourish. And you look at this, the law review article, and two thoughts might come to mind. One is, as commentator Glenn Greenwald has said, how could anybody articulate this stuff and be a law professor?
Yeah, is he going to be the one that's going to tell us which are the good ideas and which are the bad ideas?
Yeah, they think they know. But two, that professor is now head of all regulation in the Obama administration.
The guy's out of his mind.
And
there you go.
Three, even if you thought that, why would you put it in a law review article? I mean, even Cheney doesn't put stuff like that in a law review article.
Because it legitimizes it when it gets into a law review article. That's why.
Other people
read it and they say, okay, it's in this article's been published, it's in a law review, so it has legitimacy, even though he's a lunatic.
Well, he's a very smart guy.
He's running the
White House. It's called OIRA, O-I-R-A, and it's basically the top regulatory apparatus for the United States.
That's frightening. But then, you got guys like the science czar, who's a rabid eugenist, written books about population reduction and mass murders and everything. Let's get rid of everybody, and. This is sterilization, and just amazing.
Well, I think it's very.
And these guys got appointed after he became, president. We had no say in this, and then he started. I mean, this guy.
This is a shadow.
My fear is that this guy is just a Marxist, Leninist, lovey-dovey, atheist kind of person. Or monster. He could be a god miserable monster like a Stalin, a Hitler, or these kind of guys. I mean, he could actually. I mean, if you look at the people that he's putting in place here, I mean, this guy could be
dangerous.
This guy could be some wild and woolly have some very, very strange things. And he thinks nothing of going to war and killing people and having, you know, and surges and, you know. I mean, look how he handled those two pirates. I mean, he reveled in that, shooting those two guys in the head. It was almost as though he did it himself, you know. He gave the orders. But, I mean, this guy, I sense this guy is a sociopath. I have that strong feeling. And I know George Bush definitely was. No question about that. But this guy is disguised. You know, he wears a better disguise, and he scares the living hell out of me.
Well, here's something that I think is very important for your listeners, is to root all of this in what we know, and then, you know, have interpretations. But that's one of the reasons I point to this fact about Geithner's father. And this Law Review article by Cass Sunstein, the Supreme Court brief by Elena Kagan, her work with Goldman Sachs, all of these things are impressive in a positive way. But then when you combine it with things as you did, the Afghanistan War, the Iraq War, the absolute refusal to look into these Rose Bush injustices.
Right, there again, right, exactly. Another thing is putting no emphasis on the pleas from Texas and Arizona, to put up a border down there,
Well, exactly, and a lot of this stuff seems, in some crazy way, political driven. Like, well, we as Democrats, we want the Latino vote or something like that.
Well, no, isn't it? It's the new. It's,
well,
it's,
gee, you know
yeah,
what?
It's this North American Union all over.
You know, you should enforce the laws. And in my view, and I think I'm a more or less progressive person, but
I think what's undermining this personally is the North American Union, and I mean that whole pact with Canada and Mexico and the United States.
Well, again, that made a lot of people very wealthy.
It still is, you
middle
know,
class.
It, yeah.
Hurt the, and there's lots of well-paid people who say, "Oh, you don't understand. You're really much better off."
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, we sure
and that
are.
Goes back to that Austin Goolsbee comment
yeah.
that you raised earlier. But here's maybe one other thing, kind of jumping around just a little bit. But I wrote what I thought was a very important article about the justice system that ties into a lot of this this week. And I found that two of the major investigators who are supposed to look into wrongdoing by the Justice Department on torture and on political prosecutions had themselves been found to have committed major misconduct by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York in 2008. And I thought, this is, when I broke this story just a couple of weeks ago, I thought, this is crazy. Why should I, as head of this civil rights organization, the Justice Integrity Project, a small group here in Washington, find out that the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, the second most important court of the country, has ruled against these two major prosecutors who are supposed to be investigating all the other prosecutors.
Right.
And nobody else knows about it but me.
Well, that's amazing. Well, you know what's amazing to me? 9 out of 10 stories we write here, nobody's ever heard of. Not write, I mean, read on the show. Things like yourself. I mean, even bringing guests like you, yourself on here. Nobody knows this stuff. I mean, they don't.
Well, that's the importance of radio and what you do. I had been, early in my career, I worked across the border in Connecticut for the state's largest newspaper for 14 years, and I covered federal courts for 5 years before becoming an attorney.
Well, that's what we are here.
I wrote a book about disgraceful things that were occurring in the newspaper business.
You were a reporter for the Hartford Courant, is that
right.
correct? Yeah.
And I'm apparently the first American to go to Pulitzer headquarters at Columbia University look up the applications for investigative stories and then go back to the community to see if they're true what they put in the applications.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what?
What?
If no one's doing this, there's an incredible incentive to fudge the applications.
Oh, well, look at the Jason Blair. Look what happened there.
He was only a reporter.
Well, yeah, but still,
My book, 25 years ago, Spiked.
Yeah.
It's S-P-I-K-E-D. I'm not trying to sell it,
right.
But out of print.
No, sure.
But the point is that when this book came out, I became like persona non grata because all the newspapers like closed ranks. Well, the guy must be wrong, you know.
Yeah,
how could this be? But it was all there in black and white.
Sure.
And two things happened that were very interesting. One is they closed off. You can't go to Columbia Journalism School and look up those Pulitzer applications anymore.
Wow.
Try it. That's 700 journalism building, and you used to be able to just go in and look at them.
Well,
they don't want that anymore.
Yeah, they don't want it.
The second thing is that not one ombudsman in the entire country wrote a sentence about my book.
Oh,
I was on 100 radio and TV shows.
Yeah.
So that's why we need diversity of opinion, like your show, and why I'm so thrilled to be on.
We're happy to have you on. I just got to do a...
Could you hold on a station ID?
Sure.
This is WQQQ 103.3 FM in Sharon, Lakeville, and Milton. You're listening to the L.A. Steel Show. And we have our guest with us, Andrew Craig. And we are discussing the many, many aspects of the injustice system. And we will continue.
Now, you brought up a little earlier about Don Siegelman, the Alabama governor, who was charged with corruption charges, and a lot of those charges were vacated. Was that politically motivated?
Absolutely.
And who became governor as a result of that?
Who became governor?
Yeah.
Republican Robert Riley was elected in 2002, and he's still a governor.
Now, was he targeted by the DOJ?
Yes.
He was. Okay.
And I happen to know a huge amount of that, so you're going to have to really cut me off here because let me tell you a couple interesting things.
Yeah.
Okay.
First of all, Alabama had been targeted by the Republicans for years in the 1990s as a place where the Republicans could really make some hay, but there was one Democrat that they couldn't get rid of, because people liked him. And his name was Don Siegelman.
Mm.
He was kind of a fighting attorney general, a Democrat, a progressive, and they really wanted to get rid of him. So he was elected in 1999, and immediately the Republican attorney general down there launched investigations of the guys. And I found out only fairly recently, just a spine-chilling thing, which is that the investigation came to be centered at an Air Force base, and it was led by a colonel in the Air Force Reserves, and everybody worked out of the Air Force base in Montgomery, and their mission was to take out Siegelman. And in 2002, there was a phone call right after he narrowly was defeated, thanks to some manipulations on the software, people think, in Baldwin County.
Mm-hmm.
When he went to sleep on election night, he was governor, and then 6,000 votes were changed in Baldwin County. And
just hold on 1 second.
Was the United States Attorney, Laura Canary. And one of the people on that phone call, Jill Simpson, a Republican attorney, later gave a sworn affidavit alleging what happened. And she was a big Republican who worked with Karl Rove on this stuff. But she ultimately said, I'm not supposed to frame people. I'm an attorney. And do you know what? The Democrats have never called her as a witness in public.
Yeah, the Democrats.
Are they doing the same thing? Is it a horrible abuse of power?
Well, it's an incredible abuse of power. And by the way, there was a 60 Minutes expose on this.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these Republican former attorney generals, who was co-chairman of the McCain presidential campaign,
mm-hmm.
Grant Woods from Arizona, he's a big Republican, and he said, this was clearly a political prosecution to get rid of Siegelman because he was the one Democrat the Republicans couldn't get rid of. And here's the last two quick things, and then we'll go on and on. But one is the judge that presided over this trial was the largest shareholder in a military contracting company, owning up to 44% of this company that got $300 million in military contracts, most of them from the Air Force.
Yeah.
And nobody knew about this until, actually, it came out from this one whistleblower who used to work with Karl Rove. I talked with her just the other day. She's a great opposition researcher, knows stuff about things all over the country. And she ended up providing to the defense after he was convicted, well, don't you know your judge got a $180 million Air Force contract? And not only do they not know about it, but the court system and the Justice Department, even after this has been reported, won't do anything about it. And so when I say, circling back to Elena Kagan, you know, these kind of technical arguments, oh, well, he was convicted by a jury, it doesn't wash with me, and I don't think with people in the public if they knew about it.
I have a question for you, though. I mean, you've seen so much here. But, I mean, is this system worth saving? This horrid system that we have.
Yes, we've got to. I mean,
why do we have to? Can't we revise this thing? Can't we destroy this and rebuild? I mean,
well, we may have to start thinking somewhat along that line. But I mean, part of the reason, I'm a member of the National Press Club down here, and
mm-hmm.
somebody heard me on our little bit of a rant like this. Thanks for putting up with me. But somebody at the bar said, why do you care so much about this? And I said, look, I've had two careers in the press and in the law, and both of them aren't doing their job when people around the country are being framed.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question, my mother volunteered for the Marines in World War II. My father, of course, was in the military, too, fighting. And a lot of people have gone on and built up this country for us. And as bad as it is, you know, we owe it to people who have come before to put up at least a little bit of a fight.
Well, no, I understand that, and I truly understand I understand patriotism, I understand nationalism, I understand what we're doing, but this is wrong. This crap is wrong, and to fight and die for something wrong, all right, for Afghanistan, Iraq, even World War II, and we were,
yep.
when that invasion was provoked by FDR, all right, that you know, this is what tears me apart, you know, as an individual, you know, to look at the fraud in this, deceit and the criminality, okay, of the people that are spending our money, taxing us to death, okay, destroying individuals' lives like this,
yeah.
Okay, with sheer abandonment, like just joyful glee, you know, it's like, this is the glee of the wicked, you know, and yet, you know, like your mother volunteered. My father was drafted in World War II. I mean, everybody, you know, lived a wonderful, you know, went there and then came back and, you know, enjoyed the GI Bill and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it's like
Now our guys are coming back sick.
Now our guys are...
And nobody's taking care of us.
Christ, 25% of them are blowing their own brains out. Okay?
And now they want to cut.
Yeah, and they want to cut the benefits.
Cut the benefits.
So it's like,
they don't
no,
care. They're not going.
Well, this is it.
They
this
don't know anybody who's going there. It's playing on a little map with a computer for them.
But it's not just that. I mean, it's yeah, exactly. That's what it is. Like drones, you know, like
yeah.
Killing somebody.
I wonder if
these
people have a soul.
They don't. I mean, they're soulless. I mean, the people
I don't know
are
what,
soulless.
What to do, but I will say that I share your frustration. And here's a little bit of a New York story that I have two friends who are in Congress from New York.
Mm.
They're both Democrats, and I'd like to see them reelected. But they've both come to me to continue giving money, and I basically say, look, at this point, I'm a freelance writer, so, you know, I don't exactly have the check.
Yeah, here's it.
I say, I can help you a lot more. I can give you stuff that will help you do your job and fight for the public.
Mm-hmm.
And quite candidly, they have minimal interest in that. And they said, well,
it's a money
machine. I can just get elected, mm-hmm. Then I can do some things.
It's a money machine.
Yeah, that's not good enough anymore.
It's a damn money machine. That's what it is. And, you know, I absolutely outright despise, okay, politicians. Every single one of them. All right, Democrat, Republican, or independent, they're all SOBs with their hands out, okay, you know, foot-kissing SOBs, okay, every one of them. You get them in there, and what do? They sell you down the drain, okay? And I have seen this my entire life, and I'm old enough to have seen at least, what, half a dozen presidential, well, half a dozen, I don't know, even more than that, presidential elections, okay, and voted in probably eight of them. I've seen a number of presidents assassinated, candidates assassinated, civil rights leaders assassinated, all right? And, you know, and what? Because this goddamn system is still operating the same way it did back when it shot Martin Luther King, when it shot, John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, all of them.
Well, that was
you know, in 1999,
pretty bad, but I think, and I've read a lot, I think it's, on average, worse. And you've picked some horrible lowlights of the system.
Well, in 1999, the Martin Luther King Jr., his family, okay, won a civil wrongful death suit against the federal government, okay, for... which blamed and implicated the United States FBI and higher ups to assassinate Martin Luther King Jr. Okay, they won that case and got an untold amount of money. All right, undisclosed amount of money for
well, again, you're pointing to some horrible low points of our history.
What's
but
more
for
horrible?
What it's worth, I'll just say on average.
Yeah, but what's more horrible? What about the million Iraqis that we just slaughtered? Okay, not to mention the half a million Afghanistan.
Well, you're helping
that
me prove my case.
Yeah. Well, Lola, I mean, it's continual. This Grand Obama. Okay, this fraud. Okay, is doing it to us again.
All
right?
Of this is happening while we're alive. This is our history. This is our
history.
Our living history. This is our contribution to the United States.
Well, let me give you another kind of New York story. I've got a close friend. He worked with Walter Cronkite and
mm-hmm.
Huntley and Brinkley at NBC, and then he went in the CIA. And and actually, he's one of the directors of my group, the Justice Integrity Project. So I'll just name who he is. His name is John Kelly. And we were talking about the oil spill.
Yeah.
The oil leak. And what do you think he said? He said it's not a spill. It's a volcano. And he says if some reporter had been at CBS in the 60s and tried to go on air and call about a spill, Kelly told me, Cronkite would have said, what's the matter with you? Go back to your high school newspaper and learn something about journalism. It's not a spill. And so the question is, why do we keep hearing about a spill and a leak? It's a disaster.
Yeah, but, you know, Cronkite was no saint either, you know, and that chain-smoking dude there, Morrow, okay?
Yeah.
All these other guys, these were all CIA men themselves, okay? They were all part of the British MI5, all right? That's where they got their stripes, okay? And Richard Paley... was an MI5 operative who set up CBS, for crying out loud, all right, for Her Majesty the Queen, all right? So, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we have in this country, which is, that's why our mainstream media is full of crap, okay? And that's why guys like you can't get on, are lucky to get on shows that can air this stuff because, you know, we're totally blackballed, totally blacklisted by this media. And Mr. Walter Cronkite, that was no more than a big, you know, jokey farce, okay? Granddaddy Cronkite, you know?
Well,
entirely,
but just to keep things a little lively, at least there was Jack Anderson. Who's the Jack Anderson?
Oh, Jack Anderson, didn't he get assassinated or something? Or damn near tried to get assassinated?
A lot of people did. By the way, you know who did get shot? George Wallace, and while he was a segregationist, he's also the person who said there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two parties.
Absolutely.
On January 14th, 1983, President Reagan signed into effect Directive 77, which gave the CIA and government full power to determine and control the content of news that the American public receives, news which now can be uploaded or modified in minutes with modern technology.
Ahmed Dittinger, I just said that...
That was in 1983...
Right.
By President Reagan.
There you go. And Ahmadinejad just came out last week in an interview with the New Yorker, and said that we have the most restricted press in the world.
What do you think about that? Do you think that's
press
true?
In the world. All right. And he's probably. I think he's absolutely right.
Well, I'm trying to fight that in my.
And yours, yeah.
He was exactly on that theme. I wrote about how these Justice Department investigations were being conducted by people who had been found to have committed misconduct themselves.
Yeah.
And I wrote about who was willing to report that story, and not one mainstream traditional
news organization
would do it. And I told you about my book 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was finding people lying on Pulitzer applications.
Yeah, right. There you
well,
go.
Apparently you were.
Now the Columbia Journalism Review referred to me.
Well, do you remember the guy? This was a very, very famous guy in front of the press club, and he resigned as the president of or chairman or something or other. And he said he scourged the newspaper business. Very famous speech. I forget his name.
There was Newton Minow, who called TV a vast wasteland. He was head of the FCC.
This was a report. This was a publisher or an editor. Okay, a senior editor of either New York Times or...
Well, I see discussions like that all the time, necessarily from the very top editor, because you probably don't get to be the top editor.
Oh, no, he was like the top editor. He was one of the top...
He probably retired.
And he was retired.
Here's something I heard just a month ago, which is Robert Perry, who broke the story of the Iran-Contra scandal, was talking to a group at the National Press Club... in June, and he and Ray McGovern, who was a CIA agent for 30 years, agreed that you cannot understand what's going on in this country without the web internet press, because the main newspapers will not report it.
Oh, absolutely.
And Perry, who now runs Consortium News, and was a mainstream reporter. It was his view that people really did not want his story about Iran-Contra and the kind of arms smuggling and all of that.
Oh, yeah, that's nasty.
It needed to come out, and he had to fight to get that story out. And there are a number of us who feel that if Watergate happened today, people wouldn't report it.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
I agree with you.
And if Lieberman has his way, he's going to control the internet.
But at the same time, you know, I stopped reading the Time and Newsweek back in 1972, all right, or 70, what was it, 72, 73. When if you remember, Time and Newsweek were pro, they were pro Nixon for quite some time, all right, and then all of a sudden. You know, once everything was out there and everything, they did a about-face on this guy and trashed him to death, okay, and in 73 or 74, and he resigned. But I will never forget how the media turned, did a 180-degree turn on this after all of these years, all those
Well, here's one of
that,
them.
That tore me away from
heaven. Well, you're ahead of your time.
I saw it.
A young reporter, I was quite gung-ho at that time, like most of us were. But here's one of the things, jumping to the more recent type of scandals that we see, including the whole thing in Congress right now on ethics. But we see a great desire to make somebody as a scapegoat because what happens is the corruption goes along, but then, you know, the public finds out something. So everyone, including a lot of corrupt people, turn on somebody and they try to immunize themselves by going after this one person. And let me give maybe one example. We had some scandals of gay senator and gay House member.
Hastert and Foley and stuff.
Wow, you were way ahead of this. Hastert was never reported, but
he was playing around as a little boy when he was a coach.
Because that's exactly one of the things I'm talking about.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So Foley gets caught going after male interns.
Yeah.
And all of these guys, like, oh my God, there's a gay amongst us. And he's ostracized.
Well, you know, Obama's gay.
That's the thing.
Obama's gay as they get. All right. And so is his cohort there, his little gay buddy. Ram. All right. Did you read Wayne Madsen's report today? It just came out today or yesterday.
Well, Wayne has written a lot about.
Yeah, Wayne Madsen though, he came out with a new report on the Chicago sex gay sex club. Okay, and he cites names and name after name, and old Rahm Emanuel and big boy Barack. Are
the members.
Hoity-toity members there. Yes, they are. And Barack has been a member for quite some time. In fact, he's been fooling around with Bill Frist, old Bill Frist. Remember that? And according to this article, you got to read Wayne Madsen today. WayneMadsen.com, I believe it is.
WayneMadsenReport.com. I actually know Wayne. He brought someone named Larry Sinclair.
Yeah, Larry Sinclair is another one.
The Eagle Press Club last week.
Yeah, but did you know, you remember Larry, what happened to Larry?
Oh, yeah. He got arrested.
Guess who arrested him?
Bo Biden,
huh?
Attorney General.
And guess who became a vice president right after? None other than
his father?
Mr. Biden.
Joe.
Right. Immediately after he was arrested, they arrested Sinclair on an outstanding warrant. None other than Joe Biden, out of the pack of rats. What were they? Probably in 10 rats. Became the plagiarizing VP of the United States. Just amazing how these things work, huh?
Well, here's something. My family that tries to keep me in the middle of the road thought the that I was on your show talking about Wayne and Bo Biden, Dennis Hassert. They wouldn't be happy with me, but you're an interviewer who's, you know, bringing out all these topics that many, many people in Washington are extremely aware of, and the more or less the oath of silence that you have violated half of your
life. That's funny.
Well, we don't reside in Washington.
This is not pre-planned, but people who know these things are not supposed to talk about them in a way that anyone could hear, and particularly not in Poughkeepsie and other places around the country.
Yeah, southern Massachusetts and western Connecticut. We've got a very large 750,000 person coverage area.
This is supposed to be people like Dennis Hassert and the people that cover these powerful people know.
Oh, Dennis was supposedly, they used to call him Shorty.
Let's not go there.
Seriously,
that's what it was. Shorty. But anyway, that's one of those little details that's out there. And you know what? We're right to the end of our time. We had a really interesting interview with you. You have a lot of information.
I hope we didn't get you into too much trouble.
But at
any rate, a real pleasure to be on the show.
Yeah, you too.
I hope it comes back. And do you mind if I mention just very quickly my group's website?
Go right ahead.
It's justice-integrity.com. And I will say that I get a lot of calls from madams, actually, or who want a lot of stuff exposed.
There you go.
You don't go there.
Hey, maybe can you refer them to our show? Refer them to me.
They have a lot that they want to say. And
absolutely.
I say,
I'd love to talk to them.
We're trying to keep it above the belt.
Well, you live 200 feet away from Kagan. I can understand that. We live about 100, maybe 600 or 800 miles from where you are, so we're happy to talk. I wouldn't even say hello to that woman, so I got no problems. But tell me, if you can refer any of those madams or anybody who wants to talk publicly, and if you can, you know, kind of, give me the go-ahead that these people sound legitimate, I'll be happy to put them on.
I sure will, and it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, and it's been great talking to you.
All right.
Good night.
And if you want, we'd love to have you back again.
All right, love to be back.
Okay, you got it.
Bye.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
That was Andrew Herrick from the Justice Integrity Project. And he sure knows a lot about what's going on in Washington. Almost too much. It must just fill his head.
Yeah. And I want to.
Hopefully, he can make a difference in some of these abuses of power.
Yeah. And now that the Democratic and Republican primaries are done,
we will play a little music there.
Yeah, I have a tribute for them, and we will put that right on. And we're going to go away for a few minutes and see. I don't know if I like all this. I'm going to only do one song and come back and do another song. And then I've got a audio video, on Agenda 21.
Yeah, that'll be an excellent one, Leo.
Yeah,
review for all of us.
Yeah, John Brennan sent that to me the other day, and he said that would be a great one for the show, and I had to agree. So Agenda 21 will be coming up in a little while. And we want to, and we're going to go away for a couple of songs and be back in about 5-10 minutes. So I hope you enjoy. And we got some great stuff. Agenda 21 coming up, folks, for dummies. It's for real. And a talk by Edward Griffin on the United Nations. All right, so we will be back with some amazing, amazing stuff. We'll be back in just a few minutes. And this one's for all you Democrats and Republicans out there and everybody who voted. And we hope that, you know, there's been an odd kind of smell in the air today. And this kind of explains it. So, you know, if you want to, I try to play the interviews on this program each week on Wednesday nights. But if you'd like to tune in on Tuesday nights, you can go to WQQQ.com and check out our Tuesday night 2-hour program from 8 to 10 p.m. And we have guests like Andrew Craig and so many others, so many great guests. And we do discuss a lot and we break a lot of news. So, and a lot of rules. So, I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you got a lot out of it. And tell your friends, pass it around, refer this to as many people as you can, because what we talked about tonight was some serious, serious events that are happening. Dig up a little dirt on Kagan and realize what a pathetic piece of work that is. How she got slid through. And then you please go to WayneMadsonReport.com and find out about all the gay buddies of Mr. Obama and his you know, great time at the you know, the gay sex club in Chicago, here in Rahm Emanuel. So check those things out. Check those stories out. Have a great time. Have a great night. And want to join me tomorrow when we talk, when we work our way into the fourth dimension. Okay? Good night.